Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department is sticking to its guns while trying not to be heavy-handed in proposing a new rule on independent research and development. DoD wants companies to be more candid about how they're using federal funds when conducting R&D for the Pentagon. That has some defense companies worried, but some outsiders cheering. We get more now from Federal News Radio Scott Massioni.
Independent research and development is a touchy subject for the Defense Department and the companies that specialize in defense products. Last year, Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, Frank Kendall, tried to slightly raise the barrier for industry to get public funds on research and development. That put defense contractors in a tizzy and eventually DoD backed down. But now, DoD is again trying to clamp down on possible abuses in its Independent Research and Development, or IRAD, funds. The Pentagon is holding an industry day in March to discuss a proposed rule on IRAD. That rule puts in place new regulations which Kendall said were minimal when they were first proposed last year. The rule suggests that industry tell appropriate DoD personnel before it initiates any IRAD investments. It also asks that results of the investments be shared with DoD. Kendall said in September that he's looking for some meaningful technical content in the awards DoD gives out. He said requiring industry to tell government what it's doing will encourage more meaningful content. The IRAD dilemma stems from DoD's subsidizing of defense research. Here's Kendall from a speech in November to explain how that works.
The defense industry and the defense marketplace is very different than the commercial marketplace. Most customers don't pay you for R&D. In the commercial world, they don't. The government does. We do that because the investments required are very large and they're very long-term before you get a return. We buy, in many cases, very specialized, very complicated, very expensive products that take a long time to develop. And we buy them in an environment in which the assurance that there's going to be sales is kind of limited sometimes, or it's a very political environment. Every program doesn't make it to the market. So we pay for R&D. So a lot of the our total R&D budget in the department is about $65 billion. We spend about $11 or $10 billion of that on science and technology.
Over the years, industry has been accused of beefing up the IRAD funds it needs in a contract to make its bids look lower. Since IRAD costs are deducted from the total bid, companies can subtract R&D costs from what they tell the government a contract will cost. When DoD ends up awarding those IRAD funds, that money ends up going into things that can barely be considered research and development, or might not even benefit the contract or the government. The Pentagon says there's a disconnect between what the government is expecting and what industry is providing, and as a result, it wants to ensure it's aware of industry's goals and plans before funding a project. Here's former senior defense analyst at the Government Accountability Office, Sabutra Ghoshroy.
It seems to me that what goes in the name of research, that means efforts that would generate scientific knowledge that could then be disseminated amongst general public, including companies that are developing these, doing this research. That part of the RDT&E budget, which is roughly $80 billion, is relatively small. And the rest, $60, $70 billion, is all sort of development and advanced development testing, et cetera. And that doesn't create, in my opinion, a whole lot of knowledge that can really spur innovation and scientific research. It is an area where the corporations tend to make a lot more money by building prototypes, and often they don't go anywhere.
Ghoshroy mentioned that only a small part of the funding actually goes toward innovation. And innovation is what Kendall says he wants most from these companies. He told them in November he wanted defense companies to start pulling their own weight when it comes to R&D.
I would like industry to make greater investments. Industry's doing a lot of stock buybacks, which I think I understand why they're doing it. That improves some financial metrics and so on. There are other reasons to do it. But I think a better investment for the long term is in technology for future products.
Right now, what the defense companies spend of their own money on R&D is pretty small, despite the fact that sometimes their products do make it to the consumer market. Northrop Grumman spent about 4% of its revenue on R&D in 2014. Boeing spent a little over $3 billion on R&D in 2014. That's only 3% of its revenue. And Raytheon spent only 2% of its revenue on R&D. A report by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation found that spending as a share of sales by defense contractors declined by nearly one-third between 1999 and 2012. On the other hand, non-government technology companies spend billions more at a larger share of revenues. Apple spent $2 billion on R&D in the first quarter of 2015 alone. Samsung spent $13.4 billion in 2012, and Microsoft spent $10.4 billion. Here's SpaceX Chief Operating Officer Gwynne Shotwell speaking with a moderator in November about defense industry R&D spending. You'll hear the moderator first.
How does 4% sound to you for SpaceX?
Incredibly low. Very low.
And does it surprise you that that the defense establishment has an innovation problem with R&D at that levels?
No, I think it's a huge part of the reason. I think what you need to do is make sure that you're looking at markets broadly. If you are only looking to the military for your market, you're not going to have the capital to go ahead and invest what's necessary to do that. You really have to look at markets broadly.
Northrop Grumman CEO Wesley Bush said in November that industry needs the subsidized IRAD funds because it doesn't commercialize enough for its products to pay for the R&D, and because some of the technologies should be kept secret from adversaries. Here's Bush.
Yes, we are investing collectively, both us and our customers, an enormous amount in advanced technology, but we're doing it for a purpose that we are not going to commercialize. And the moment we begin to commercialize it, that begins to wash away technological superiority. So not all R&D is created equal. And in fact, that part that's not equal, we want on our side. We want it for defense. And I think we have to be careful about the vocabulary that we use, because we will end up conveying a very inappropriate message about what we do.
Of course, that doesn't take into account once a technology becomes old news, if the defense company can finally commercialize it. We'll find out more on the rule, its fate, and stakeholder reaction during the Industry Day next month. In Washington, Scott Massioni, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Read Scott's story and share this interview with colleagues at FederalNewsRadio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department is in the midst of an ambitious effort to redefine the work roles, job descriptions, qualification standards, and training requirements. That's for all of its information technology personnel. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, Pentagon brass think there are too many seams between the parts of its workforce responsible for cybersecurity and those who keep its systems running day by day.
The objective of the relook at the IT workforce was to make clear that virtually every employee needs to be involved in the critical work of applying security patches and making sure all of the systems are properly configured. That's because misconfigurations and unpatched systems represents by far the Defense Department's biggest single vulnerability to cyber threats. And Richard Hale, DOD's Deputy Chief Information Officer for Cybersecurity, says fixing those holes can't be a job just for a narrow set of workers with cyber in their titles.
It finally dawned on me when I went into some data center somewhere in DOD, and you know, there were these people running applications, and they knew their customers, and they knew all about the technology, the application, and they knew what to do when something went wrong, and they were often the Tier 3 help desk, so they actually talked to their customers regularly. And so they knew everything about that mission and the technology supporting it. And I said, good, tell me about what you guys are doing in cybersecurity. And they said, we got other people for that. We don't actually know them. They're a thing called a computer network defense service provider. They sit somewhere else. They put a box on our wire, and they talk to us once in a while. But we here in this data center don't have any cybersecurity responsibility. It's like, oh, dear.
Hale speaking this week at a cyber conference hosted by Federal Computer Week in Washington. The security people in question are DOD's computer network defense service providers. There are 22 in all, and in theory, every computer in the department is supposed to be protected by one of them. DOD had already announced it in its 2015 cyber strategy that it wanted to re-examine whether the CNDSPs were up to the task, but Hale suggested Wednesday that their role would become highly specialized, as opposed to bearing the entire day-to-day burden of ensuring the security of networks that they don't actually manage.
So we crafted our policies and our responsibilities incorrectly. Okay, so that's another lesson. You gotta get the job descriptions right, and so we're in the middle of an effort to redefine the work roles, the job descriptions, the qualification standards, the training standards for the whole information technology workforce in the department. Remember I said a little earlier that computer science hasn't quite adjusted to this idea that the environment is not benign, neither has our notion of what the IT workforce ought to be. So every single person, just like safety in the airplane business, every single person in that IT workforce has to have a cybersecurity job, but they have to know that they have the job, they have to know how to do it, right? So we need to take care of these folks. We need to train them. We need to hold them accountable for that. We need to take care of them and make sure there are good career paths for this. But every single person in that business needs to have a cybersecurity job. So again, we're going about that. We're DOD. Things happen slowly. But this year, we already have put policy out that starts this process. We've started the work role standards. And we're making good progress. There are a lot of people throughout the department helping with that, so we get this right. So stay tuned. But the idea is your whole IT workforce has to do this. You can't just be some cybersecurity guys. You still need some experts, but everybody has to play.
Additionally, DOD's review of the CNDSPs has found that there were some systems that none of them had actually been assigned to monitor and secure. Hale says the department was taking steps to remedy that. The department also needs to better define the roles of the 68 cyber protection teams each of the military services have been building under the auspices of U.S. Cyber Command. Until now, their jobs have been to fly to DOD sites suffering cyber emergencies and fend off attacks, but Hale says DOD wants them to have a more day-to-day role in defending defense networks.
Those teams so far have generally been focused on incident response. So they're a force that Cyber Command can deploy when there's a problem, and that's also a really good way to learn what bad guys are doing for these teams. But this year we have initiatives to better integrate the CNDSPs and the cyber protection teams so that we have an integrated approach, because computer network defense service providers do day-to-day monitoring for vulnerability, monitoring for anomaly, detection, diagnosis, and really reaction to cyber attack, working with whatever place has been cyber attack. So by the end of the year, I think we'll have a more solid notion about the integration between these CPTs, which are focused mostly on flying in right now and helping, but we want them focused more on making sure particular mission threads, for instance, are secure end-to-end, working with the many CNDSPs that perhaps are involved in a particular mission. And then as we redefine these IT work roles, we'll continue to define how these different groups relate.
Hale says DOD also needs to make progress on automating some of the work involved in auditing its computers to make sure they're correctly configured and adequately patched in the first place. That information is already gathered and reported from across DOD, but in many cases, it's self-reported.
Self-reporting of whether a computer is configured properly or not generally is wildly inaccurate. People will assert it, and they will believe it. Right? I don't think anybody is lying when they assert it, but if we put a team on the ground or can do a remote measurement, it turns out not to be so many times. So you have to measure it automatically. Even if a commander may want to report it manually, a commander has to have automated measurement or they just won't really know. So one of our challenges is getting that measurement in place. Really what we'd like is not just measurement, but we'd like automatically to make sure that thing is configured properly, and then the commander can know that. So another challenge is doing the automation in a way that gives us the automation of the configuration management process itself and patching process. So we're working through that. We will not probably have a single DoD standard way to do all of those things, each military service, and then the, DoD has many, many organizations outside of the military service. Many of them already have ways to do some of this stuff automatically, so we're not trying to push a common standard.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click share with friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The military services have been dithering with Congress over if and where to reduce their real estate footprint. But there's one spot in the world where the Army is undergoing a major expansion in real estate. Camp Humphreys, South Korea, is undergoing a major multi-billion dollar makeover. Joining me with details of what's going on and why, the Army Assistant Secretary for Installations, Energy, and Environment, Catherine Hammack. Ms. Hammack, thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Tom.
Tell us about Camp Humphreys itself and what goes on there.
Our strategy with basing in Korea has been to consolidate and shrink our footprint. So in 2003, we had 174 sites on 57,000 acres. And in 2018, we'll have less than 100 sites on 21,000 acres. So although you're absolutely right, Camp Humphreys has tripled in size, it is to accommodate much of the consolidation.
How long has this been in the works?
We started in 2002 with an agreement with the Republic of Korea to facilitate construction. And in 2007 is that when we really started land expansion. Because to build this out, the Republic of Korea acquired rice paddies and had to fill them in with dirt. So it took 11 million cubic meters of dirt, which is roughly equivalent to filling Yankee Stadium 10 times over to expand this base.
And so that was a cost to the Army or to Korea?
No, the cost has been largely covered by Korea. So the cost of the consolidated base is estimated at about $10.7 billion, of which over 90% is paid for by the South Koreans.
So I guess they and the Army and the United States really consider that a important strategic post.
Absolutely. And we're relocating the majority of forces and families south out of Seoul, reducing the number of camps and sites that we have in South Korea, and returning valuable real estate to the ROK in Seoul and surrounding areas that they can then use to further their growth. But really, it reduces our operational costs with more efficient basing.
And how many troops are there now, and how many will be there when this whole thing is finished?
Well, originally, Camp Humphreys is about 10,000 people, and that included military, civilians, and contractors. But when we're complete, it's going to be about 42,000 people daily assessing the base and working there. The thing to keep in mind, though, is Seoul, where we are based right now in a multitude of sites, has roughly a population density that's four times that of New York City. So our missions there in Seoul and the training of the troops was really incompatible with the way Seoul has developed over the last couple of decades. So moving south out of Seoul gives us a little bit of elbow room for us to do the military mission.
And how far away from Seoul is Camp Humphreys?
It is about a two-hour drive, but there is a fast train there that can get you there in just a little bit over an hour.
And there's aircraft and helicopters and troops and the whole nine yards.
Absolutely, and a river, so it's very accessible.
Tell us about the progress. How far from complete is this expansion at this point?
Well, in 2015, just last year, we reached the peak of construction. And so we're now at 70% completion of all projects, and it's going to be in 2018 roughly when the majority of the construction is complete.
And is it buildings or also runways?
There's buildings, office buildings. There are tactical equipment maintenance facilities. There's runways. There's hangars. It's an amazing construction project.
How big will it be when it's finished?
But when it's finished, it's a little over 3,700 acres.
Okay.
It is a small city because if you can imagine 42,000 people daily assessing it, you know, in and out of the gates, and that's, you know, again, military, civilians, contractors, and even some families that will be down there.
And how does this relate to what the Army is doing strategically in the Korean Peninsula? I mean, we've had the pivot to Asia over the past couple of years. Is this part of that, or does it supersede that?
It really is part of that overall strategy, because the mission of the United States and the ROK Alliance is to deter aggression. And we deter North Korean aggression by ensuring our forces are ready to fight. The U.S. military presence there is a crucial deterrent, and some South Korean officials worry that a lessening of the U.S. role could embolden North Korea. And you're absolutely right. North Korea's recent hostile rhetoric and military brinkmanship have added to those concerns.
Catherine Hammack is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.